Hey, what's going on? Welcome to The Doug Show. My name is Doug Cunnington, and today I'm talking to Chris Piantelli from Linkify, and I've known Chris for a few years. We haven't met in person yet, but we've talked many times on the pod. We're going to talk digital PR and some of the changes that have, really affected the entire industry overall from an SEO perspective, but there's a lot of stuff in the Linkify world, in the digital PR world, that has changed quite a bit. So Chris, how's it going today?
Yes, very good. Thank you. Yeah, it's been a few years now, hasn't it? So I'd say friends now.
Yeah. So yeah. It's good to speak with you. Thanks for agreeing to chat. And I do want to give a shout out to Linkify. You guys did a couple campaigns for me over the last couple of years. I'll actually put the links in the description and show notes so people can check it out. But it's amazing. So it's a DR 92, 91, a 90, an 82, an 86, 72, and 68, including Ahrefs, NASDAQ.com, Go Banking Rates, Yahoo Finance, places that I probably wouldn't have been able to land the link. So you guys did an excellent job. And I just want people to understand sort of the links that we're talking about when we're talking about digital PR. So we're going to go through a lot of news. So I will mention that we've done a couple interviews before. So I'll point people towards those to get a little bit more about your story and background and how you got started with all of this. But one of the bigger things out there was the death of Haro. So Help a Reporter Out is something I heard about when I first started online over 10 years ago, and it had been around before that. And I believe they were acquired and or rebranded. And then shortly after that, they closed up shop. So what is the story with that, Chris? And I'll just leave it open for you to tell that story.
Sure. Do you want to start with a minute silence or something for the death of Haro? Or get straight in? Yeah, it was crazy, crazy time. So Haro was founded about 15 years ago by a guy called Peter Shankman, who's a really nice guy. We had him on our podcast, actually. And he opened up this service, which was a free at the point of service to connect journalists with expert sources, three emails a day, Monday to Friday. Everybody got really used to that sort of system. And it worked really well and allowed small businesses, really, which was the reason Peter Shankman set it up, to get press coverage and media attention. And then a few years into that process, I think SEOs and link builders recognized that it was a great opportunity to win backlinks. And then Peter then sold it to Sisyon, which is another company. And it still carried on in the exact same format that it originally did. It was still a free to use, three emails a day. But then I think maybe 3-4 years ago, it was Sisyon itself, which is a wider, larger media corporation, was purchased by private equity. And then that's when we started seeing things, sort of the sands shift, as it were. So they started by going after agencies selling quote unquote Haro links. So we actually got a cease and desist from Sisyon for using their copyrighted term Haro on our website. So that was a stressful 48 hours when I was in Thailand, in Bangkok, with my now wife, reading emails from lawyers saying that they were going to, take aggressive legal action. But anyway, we were able to move that. The industry responded to that quite quickly. And we started referring to Haro links as what they are, which is expert quote links, just some sort of basic copywriting changes to the websites and stuff. And then everything seemingly got back to normal and carried on. Then they said that they were changing the email-based system, which likely was a response to the AI mass response bombardment. I'm sure all the journalists that were using Haro were getting in their inboxes. So this was around the time that ChatGPT had been prevalent for, let's say, 12 to 18 months. Everybody figured out that rather than handcrafting one or two pitches a day, that they could, mass spam every single query in there. So Sisyon then said that they were going to change to a platform-based system that you logged in and you had to do everything within this housed system. And then it also went from a free system to a freemium pay-to-play model. It wasn't prohibitively expensive. I think it was a dollar a pitch, let's say. But I think that was their response to try and curb and combat that AI spam. And it actually went really well, especially for us as an agency. It did, I think, cut that spam. Our win rates went like really, really high. And there were still really good publications sourcing for expert commentary on the platform. Everything was running relatively smoothly. And then all of a sudden, out of the blue, they just said, thanks a lot, everyone. We'll be shutting down the service, which was crazy.
Damn. And I thought, you know, we talked around the time period of the rebranding, which was only, I mean, that was like the fall of 24, right?
Mm-hmm. Connectively, yeah. They said that they were going to change the name and the system and all that, yeah.
And then with the, you know, the charging, I was like, that's actually a decent move because mm-hmm. of the proliferation of AI and the ability for people to automate. In fact, I was contacted more than once by at least one to two companies that set up a AI system where like they would pitch, basically, like you said, they would pitch everything and they were charging, you know, extremely low rates because like once they had the system set up, it was very cheap for them to run. And I get a lot of pitches. I resisted talking to them because I knew this was like short-lived. Like any time, like if someone could figure out how to do it, then that means many other people have figured out how to do it too. So like it was only a matter of time before everyone was sending AI answers back and it's just like pretty much useless. It's like too much for the reporters to sift through. Okay. Well, your business was basically built on top of Haro in the beginning. And I think you diversify. There's other ways to get these links. So how were you dealing with this as a business owner and knowing that you need to keep this running? You actually have, you know, not only do you want to have new clients coming in, you have clients that have already paid you and you're running their campaign. So what was this like mentally, emotionally, psychologically?
It actually wasn't as bad as it sounds. In the early days of having Linkify, when we were basically a Haro agency, we basically started life as a company quite organically. I was doing Haro link building. My then business partner had some, was it like a link builder, but not like PR link building. He was doing, you know, more full SEO link building campaigns, skyscraper, guest post, that sort of stuff. And then he saw my link profile and said, hey, do you think you could earn these Haro style links for some of his clients? I said I could give it a go. And then that's how our company started. As we progressed and started to grow and scale, obviously sort of the magic gold dust was queries, more queries. Where can we find more queries for more opportunities? And it quickly became apparent that there were in fact multiple places to find these queries. And actually the journalists that were looking for these queries were submitting their journalist requests across multiple platforms. So they wanted to go as far and wide as they could, and they would use basically any platform or system that would allow them. And actually, most tier one journalists, or certainly a significant amount of tier one journalists that are frequently sourcing for expert commentary, are actually posting those requests directly on their social media as well. So they'll blue sky threads, Twitter, they'll post and say, you know, I'm sourcing for a fitness expert. I'm writing an article for menshealth.com. I'm looking for someone, a fitness expert, to give me three ways to X, Y, and Z. And you'll see that query on multiple places and also directly from the journalist. So as we were scaling, we built our own sort of automated in-house system where we pull all the queries from all the possible sources. We also monitor and track all of the tier one journalists. We also know when the journalists move jobs and go from one publication to another. We track their social handles, and then we just pull everything in and then we sift through. And then we assign accordingly to the clients that we think they're a good fit for. So actually, Haro as a single point of failure, it wasn't an issue at all. And actually, funnily enough, Peter Shankman had already started a new platform even before Connectively went down. which he actually called Hero at the time. So not Harrow, but Hero. And when we had him on our podcast, he said he'd done that to piss off Sissian. And I think he got a cease and desist within about a month of launching that. And he said he knew it was coming. So he already had a backup name and a backup domain, which it now lives today as SOS, Source of Sources, which is essentially exactly what Harrow was when he originally founded it, or, you know, over 15 years ago.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And does SOS like look a little more modern? I remember Haro looked like it was from 2007 or whatever.
I mean, it's just not identical looking. It's very, very similar. The user base isn't as big as Haro was in its prime. So there does seem to have been a dispersion of maybe where journalists prioritize the ones that will just source from one or two places. There's also, I mean, there's many other platforms I can tell you about, but no, it's still got that classic look. But hey, if you're someone who likes things to not change, then it's perfect. And it's still exactly what you want it to be, which is you can see the queries, you can go through them, and you can answer what you want. And a lot of people like that.
So one thing I want to highlight and go back to a little bit is, you know, the fact that you realize that connecting directly with a journalist via their social media or otherwise and keeping track of them was really valuable. What you find, and I'm completely on the outside, but even I see this where a lot of the journalists are freelancers. They write for whoever will hire them, and they're writing all the time for different places. So, you know, if you just follow them in one area, you're going to miss a lot of stuff, meaning the publication. So if you just follow New York Times, you're going to miss all the other stuff that that person is doing. How much did AI, or how much are you using AI in sort of like sifting through all the data and or pulling the data? Because, you know, back in the day, even just like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, like you would probably have to manually look through. You could do some sorting, but you would probably have to have a person review the data that you're pulling in. But now it seems like AI is so good, you can give it some good instructions and you're probably getting most of what you need. So are you using AI in that way?
We're using a lot of automation. And then so there's a lot of AI on the back end of like the automations that we're doing. And we are using AI as well to engage journalists, albeit in a very like structured way. We also use AI to ensure that the pitches we send don't get detected as AI. And then obviously we don't just do, I like to put Harrow or the umbrella term, the old umbrella term for these inbound PR requests as an inbound form of PR activity. So that's where the stuff's coming into you basically. But we also do outbound, which is where we come up with the stories and then you sort of are outreaching to the journalists with your story, as opposed to waiting for them to say, I'm working on a story and I'm looking for an expert. We go to them and say, hey, we've got a story, we're an expert. So that's the outbound, inbound as well. Outbound does really, really well with data. So I think the new winners in the digital PR link building space are going to be the ones that can gather, analyze, interpret, and find narrative within data at mass using AI. I wish I was like an amazing coder, but I think as the weeks and days go by, the tools for us to interact with AI in order to get it to do stuff that we want it to do as non-coders is getting here faster and faster every day.
It's pretty amazing. You mentioned using AI for, you know, just generating the outreach, but you also mentioned that you're using AI to help it not be detected, which is a classic thing. So how are you doing this? And I think I asked you the last time you were on, and this is a kind of an evergreen topic now, but yeah, what are you doing?
Yeah, but I think it's got to a point now where it's going to become largely irrelevant, but whilst it's not, then it's something you have to take account of. So I think the journalists are being mandated to by their publications and the editorial teams for which they're writing and producing articles that this must pass AI detection. So I think it's got to the point now where even though it's an issue for the editorial teams and the journalists that are writing, and bear in mind that if a publication hires a freelance journalist or, you know, a beat journalist to produce a piece of content, then they are well within their right to expect for that journalist to not have used AI to write that content, or at least not to have blatantly used AI where they could have just cut out the middleman and not paid the journalist to do anything. So you can understand why this stuff's being tested, but it's going to get to the point where it's undetectable anyway, and the detectors themselves are just no good. Like, I don't know if you've played with AI detection tools at all, if you've written a paragraph or two paragraphs of your own text and it's flagged as 100% AI, and you can take a piece of text and run it through some dodgy DAI machine that adds like a weird full stop in the middle, and then it becomes 100% human. There's just no rhyme or reason to it. It's not an exact science, and it just seems a bit pointless. But as we are living in an era where journalists are checking and using these tools, then if we want to maximize our chances of winning pitches, then what we send off, we should also check to make sure it passes these tools. Because if they're doing it, even if it's not AI or the detection tools rubbish or blah, 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 they're still checking it. And you may just be put in a bin of like 100 other pitches that they're just auto dismissing based on a simple check from, you know, Zero GPT or any of the other detection tools. So how do we use it? We use some like pretty basic DAI prompts. We aggressively change the prompts and like iterate on the new models and try and find different ways. It works a lot better if you break stuff down into chunks. So rather than taking like a three paragraph response and asking AI to DAI that full piece of text, if you break it down into sentences, or if you engage with the ChatGPT as it's meant to be engaged with, which is like, you know, chatting to it, you could take individual sentences or elements, and you can find what's being flagged as AI in these AI detection tools. It'll sort of highlight the areas. So you could take those specific areas and say, you know, could you use X, Y, and Z to enhance this? It's quite a laborious task, but they are checking. So I think it's worth doing.
Right. And, you know, you mentioned, have I used the tools? I have used the AI detectors, but it was like probably 18 months ago now. And then to your point, it's like, it didn't matter because I put in actually a transcript of me speaking like a podcast or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was like, whatever, 90% AI. So it was like, okay, this is obviously like, there's too many false positives, false negatives. Yeah. Like you're mentioning like different ways to like disrupt the AI detection, even though it's like perhaps the same text or really close to it. So yeah, from my perspective, it's just like, it was an interesting thing in the beginning. I think there were a lot of like AI tools, and I actually heard of some where it's like, I developed this AI tool, I did this stuff, and then people sold it. And I think that was like the right move, just like develop something, get the hell out of there. This is going to be useless in like 2 months. And then, you know, it's bigger companies trying to acquire stuff, but interesting projects. And I see people with like, you know, this is a whole movement, right? It's like no coding skills to like, here's how you can code with this stuff, which is it's interesting to me. It's been a long time since I coded, but I have like a computer engineering degree. So I spent whatever fucking hundreds of hours like coding and like debugging and doing all this stuff. And now it's like, you know, it could be solved really quickly.
Yeah. Are you a coder then? Can you do that?
These days I would say I'm not a coder, but technically I could. I probably like in a day I could like catch up to like some other stuff. But I took, like I said, hundreds of hours of classes around coding. Yeah.
You've got to play with, there's a couple of natural language coding tools that are out, which I've been playing with. There's one called bolt.new. I don't know if you've come across this. Another one called lovable.dev. Honestly, I've built like, I'm working on a press badge maker. It's basically ready. I just haven't launched it yet. So I coded an entire front end. You go in, it's got like, it looks great. You can go and take three URLs or five URLs, you select which one you want, of websites where you've been featured before. Then it will slot the URLs in and then produce a button to hit generate press badge maker. So they click that. It's then connected to a background image remover API. It's got a database on something called Superbase. It then like blurs the HTML code that it produces after it makes like a press badge, which is the three logos. It's options to then change the background color, to style it, and then it gives you the HTML code. It's blurred. The person has to then click to sign up, gives them a password, signs them up, and then shows them the HTML code. And I did all of that with natural language, just saying, can you make it do this now? And it's like, oh, you need an API key. Okay, which API key should I get? Go to this website, get that API key. Okay, it's taken me about 40 hours probably, which is way too much, but I don't know anything. But right, it works, man.
Interesting. It is so cool because it was unobtainable before. You would have to, I mean, you could do it, but you would be like looking through documentation. You would, I mean, there is this, I mean, one of the skills of like coding is like to be able to look through the libraries and see what call you actually need and how to make those calls. But you're just like, you don't have to do all that shit. And the thing is like, obviously, well, maybe it's not obvious. It's like, you said it took you 40 hours or whatever. And technically, I mean, it would probably take me 45 because I'm like even less aware of it now. But like, if I like refreshed my skills in a certain area, then I potentially, like a skilled coder, can do it so much faster because they don't have to go and Google shit and see, you know, how a specific call is used or whatever. And it just speeds everything up. Or debugging, where it's just like in the past you had to look through and find your syntax error with a fucking semicolon. Yeah. And now it's just like, you don't have to do that. So,
well, that's why I wanted to tell you about it. Cause even if you've got like any previous knowledge of this stuff, then you're going to be miles ahead of everyone else. But it's almost leveled the playing field for like dreamers and thinkers and tinkerers and imaginers, because like, you know, it's expensive to hire a dev team if you've got an idea. Like, I remember when I was like, I don't know, 15 years ago, I had an idea for an app, let's say. Like, I looked into it and it was going to cost like 20 grand to get, you know, this basic. So it was just unobtainable for me to even entertain the idea of getting into the app development game. But like now, especially like, you know, in the online business, we're always coming up with ideas of like how we could make stuff better. Me with digital PR and like gathering data or finding information on particular journalists in order to make different campaigns more interesting. And we can automate and create tools that can speed this up. And even now, even if it's just to the point where, you know, I could go in and like code something that like kind of looks like I want it, works, but doesn't. But that could be like 60% of the cost of a development project. And then you just take it to someone else to like bring it over the finish line. So it's super exciting time.
Man, and it's, yeah, I think someone could develop like a whole podcast and YouTube channel just talking about this portion of it. I'm sure they're out there where it's just like non-coders coding, like average coders becoming like elite kind of coders and that sort of thing. Okay. So I'll close that portion up and just say, I've had an interest every now and then, but I'm doing like less stuff online. So I'm not running into like digital problems that I need to solve. And I think that's the key where you're like, I have this problem. There's not a solution out there. And I want to like create one. And I think, I mean, there's obviously like plenty of problems out there to be solved, but because I'm like, whatever, I'm like writing in a note, I'm writing on a notepad. Like there's less digital problems I'm trying to solve. So as we,
I'm still a notepad.
There's something better about that. That said, I have like a million post-it notes and notes and Google Docs. So it's just really, it's just scattered fucking everywhere.
You sound like me. Yeah. I've got duplicates. I've got paper notes that are like as the same as the digital notes, Notion notes.
Yeah, I like it. And I think maybe that's the problem. I should be able to just like take pictures of everything and it's like consolidate this mess into like one document here. So, Okay. Moving on, you were essentially getting into where digital PR is moving these days. And part of it, you know, reaching out to people directly, using AI, but not too much. Where else is digital PR going? Are there any trends, anything like that?
So it's becoming a lot more now about the personal company or the brand, the expertise and the authority behind the pieces that they're going out with. So whether or not that's answering Harrow questions or like Harrow styled inbound expert quote questions. Long gone are the days where you could just be a finance expert and answer a finance question. If you want to get quoted in a big finance publication or in a big tier one publication giving finance commentary, then you really need to be like an actual finance expert, like a CPA or a CFP or an accountant or the ex-head of HSBC banking conglomerate, something like that. Not necessarily to that extreme, but this is who you're competing with in order to win that coverage. And then also we have to think about the publications themselves. Like many of them have had reductions in writing staff and they're losing readership to all of the other places that people can, you know, consume their media. So I think the opportunities are probably going to be in somewhat of a decline, and then the competition is going to be heating up. So I think it will get harder and harder. Having said that, I still think there is a continual and will forever be a need for new content and news. Like I personally can't ever see that going away. I love the news, even if it's a fluff piece or an important piece. These places are still going to need to exist in order to deliver good quality news. And then within that, there are PR opportunities. So yeah, I think it's going to be about, in order to achieve it on an agency level, it's going to be about systems, processes, contacts, relationships, new ideas, new ways of doing stuff. And in terms of, you know, getting yourself featured is, and this is true of doing well in Google and appearing in large language models and existing still as a business, it's going to be about brand building and having a recognizable either brand or personal brand, because that's going to be the future of everything, I think.
And one of the notes that you sent over in preparation was around other advantages of doing digital PR. And part of it is having that brand out there in the world, not just SEO, but in essentially AI tools or LLMs in general. Can you expand on that a little bit and, you know, I guess give context around it?
Yeah. Well, people are changing the way they search, aren't they? That's it's not just Google now. I mean, it is for a lot of stuff, but a lot of search happens not on Google now. It was the dominant search engine. I think it fell below 90% of the search, the like real estate for the first time in 15 years, something like that. Now, those stats don't necessarily take into account the large language models. I think it's just a search engine based. I think it's, I can't remember the name, Bright Data, where that data comes from. But we know people are searching in places outside of Google. YouTube is a search engine. And then you've got like non-Google entities, Perplexity, ChatGPT search now has a search feature. And then DeepSeek is also, you know, a new language model. People are searching on social, TikTok, Instagram. So search is happening in many, many places. And the way that we succeed with our businesses is to be found. So we have clients that will say that, you know, they track their referrals. I think it's less easy to do with places like ChatGPT on a sort of cookie sort of tracking level, but certainly they've been told in, you know, forms that customers said, I found you on ChatGPT, which is scary to think, you know, you could be saying, you know, is there a good plumber near me? Or, you know, I'm in such and such town, what's the best plumber? And then it's recommending plumbers. So if you're a home or local service business, like if people are going to be searching in those places, you've got to try and get there. Like you don't want to be one of the four main plumbers in your town. And if somebody asks what are the best plumbers in that town on ChatGPT, it only ever surfaces the three and not you. So you're never going to get business from that search platform. So we need to try and get ourselves into the large language models. It's still early to give any definitive, do X, Y, and Z, and you'll appear in all large language models. We don't even fully understand like how they work. We know that they're not directly tapping into an index per se, like Google does. Although, for example, ChatGPT's built or leverages the Bing index. So we know that they're going to rely on trusted sources. That's logical. And trusted sources tends to be places like tier one media. There was a study done by, not a massive study, but a study done by Grow and Convert recently, where they looked at keywords from 18 companies, I think, and keywords. And it showed that 80% of the businesses that were surfaced in the AI results were also ranking in the top 10 on the first page of Google. So Google itself is, you know, an arbiter of truth in some ways with its first page of results. So I think the whole thing needs to be holistic. Like, we've got to be brand building, being everywhere, and being aligning ourselves with bigger and more trusted entities. So I can't give you a definitive strategy, but being on podcasts, networking, doing good SEO and building good links and getting tier one media coverage and being talked about in lots of different places can only go to feed the new beast and give us a chance, I think, to appear in all the places that we want to appear.
Right. And I've seen this as well, just in a general sense, like where someone will Google me and I have a lot of content out there. So, you know, there's a knowledge panel on Google, but there's other information and I have checked like keyword golden ratio within some of the LLMs and it's cool. It pops up, you know, mostly accurate. I don't know. I can't remember. It's probably fine. It probably just, of course, copied it from somewhere else. So it's probably fairly accurate, but it's kind of interesting like how deep they go because I'm just a random dude that made up something and produces some content out there, but it's like, it has information about me. I should like look deeper and see what kind of crazy stuff is out there. But when I chatted with some of the local newsletter creators in the past few months, one thing that they mentioned was just having some presence out there, not necessarily like PR mentions, but if they have that, that's huge for working with companies and actually getting advertisers. So the example that they gave was just having like a presence on social media. It gives them some credibility. Well, if you add like actual like press mentions or you're featured in the local magazine or whatever, like that's pretty big too. And it's like, oh, a journalist actually valued whatever that person has. So before we get into some other stuff here, you mentioned that you have a cheat sheet, and I think it has some information about other places that people can go for digital PR. I don't want to bury it at the end of the episode, so I'm going to let you talk about it now. So I tricked all the listeners out there.
You're nice. Yeah. So yeah, Harrow's gone, but it's not the, what do I say? Harrow is dead. Long live Harrow, something like that. So there are loads of other places to go. We've got a cheat sheet, which you can get completely free. And I walk you through from top to bottom how to basically start getting winning press coverage for yourself. I'll tell you the first five links that you can definitely win, really, really high quality publications. I go through, I think there's a prompt in there so you can work some of your ideas into an amazing pitch that won't need any editing. I also break down the other places that you can find these requests. Almost all of them are free. Yeah, so it's all in there. It's completely free. So that would be great if anyone wants to go and get that. I think you said you'd leave the link in the show notes.
Yep, exactly. So people could go there and check it out. And yeah, it should get people started. It's a tight resource, so people should check it out. Okay. So as we're transitioning, I'll let you, if I missed anything, Haro, digital PR wise, anything else you want to add before we talk about kind of the niche site industry and SEO industry overall? So anything that I missed?
No, I think we covered it all. If people are wanting to proactively go and start earning themselves coverage on big publications, I think the benefits are above and beyond that of just the SEO value of the link. We are seeing so much more benefits from doing this, which is things like if you are an e-commerce website, or for example, if you own a local newsletter and that local newsletter has a landing page, you can get those 3, 4, 5 logos. So for example, you, Doug, have like a niche site resource page that we built some links to. We got you featured in Ahrefs, which is an amazing niche topical, like tier one resource that if you slap on your front page, if somebody goes to that page and goes, "Ah, can I trust this Doug guy? He looks a bit shifty. Oh, wow, he's been featured in Ahrefs and a bunch of other places." You're going to increase customer conversion, customer trust. And then as well, like I said, the large language models, you also get the referral traffic if you are getting featured on these big sites with lots of traffic. And then you're also like getting in front of people that are reading stories that are somewhat or tightly aligned to the niche and industry that you're operating in. So it's almost a passive way of networking because you never know who's going to read it. Somebody might just be looking for the exact service that you offer or what the quote that you've said might really resonate with them. They may add you on LinkedIn. You may then, you know, see that they've added you. And it's a way of growing your network. And we all know the benefits of that, but passively. So yeah, the benefits are just, it's definitely worth doing.
Well said. So Chris, you've been to a handful of SEO conferences here recently. I think you went to SEO Chiang Mai or Chiang Mai SEO conference. Mm-hmm. How was that? I mean, the thing is, like, it's been going on for obviously years and it runs the range, but my sort of circle of audience and most of the people that I was, you know, friends with, they were more on the content side of websites and maybe dabbled with some higher level SEO, maybe agency stuff. But I mean, from the niche site world, a lot of it has like evaporated since the helpful content update, AI really changed things, and it's been kind of a shit show overall. So a lot of people just kind of like either lost their sites or traffic went down by 90%, or if people were like getting started, they have gone to other areas. So what was the vibe there in Chiang Mai?
Yeah, this year there was definitely, I mean, it was a positive vibe, but I think niche sites is probably quite a relatively small area of SEO. SEO is like a multi-billion dollar industry. If you think about the amount of websites that utilize SEO in order to drive business, then, you know, niche sites are really a fraction of that. So you get a lot of the top people in the room at these places, especially Chiang Mai SEO, a lot of enterprise SEO people. And then you have people on the fringes of SEO. So, I mean, SEO is just search engine optimization. There was a talk from a guy there that was crushing it on YouTube, which is an easier search engine to rank in, one could say. So yeah, the vibe was pretty optimistic. A lot of people bullish on AI and the opportunities that's going to bring. I think the problem with like the whole niche and affiliate site downfall was it was that gateway into the industry for like, you know, I've never done anything before. Find something that you're interested in. You can produce some content and you could start ranking and making money. So we all, well, many of us experienced that. Like I did, I'm sure you did, a site that you just sort of learned. You almost learned what you were doing on that first site that you had as well. But then it started ranking and it was like, holy shit. And then you got ads like connected and you added a couple of affiliate links. And then you were like making money and you were like, shit, I'm like, I'm an online marketer. I can. And then it was like, you got the bug. And then, you know, people obviously 2-3 years into the journey had multiple sites. I know people that got hit with big, big sites doing, you know, maybe a million sessions a month, organic sessions a month. So making crazy good money. Even some big people that talk, you know, we've seen some of the niche influencers that got hit, tens and thousands of dollars lost. So it's crushing. But like I said, in the dawn of AI, I think it's still a gateway for people to get involved and try things. I just don't think it's that Google cut off that doorway of like, I don't really know what I'm doing. Here's some okay content. I want to make loads of money. It's like, it's just got that. You can't do that anymore, basically.
I like the way you frame that too, because, you know, number one, when you're in a subculture, you feel like it's huge. And I like to think I'm very self-aware. So I'm in multiple little subcultures. So I see like, you know, someone's a huge, like, in air quotes, influencer in that industry, but you go like just to an adjacent subculture, people don't even know who that person is or what you're even talking about, even though they're like very closely related. And it's interesting because you're exactly right, where like content websites were a very easy gateway where like someone is like, they've heard about it. Like it kind of went mainstream because there were stories on like CNBC and, you know, other like national or, you know, worldwide publications where like these stories are covered, where it's like average single mom at home is like doing this business. And there are other areas that people can get started, but like there was kind of a clear framework and roadmap, even though it changed over the years, where like someone can start a website and start blogging. And then this has changed so much, but it is just a tiny little portion of the industry. And, you know, I guess kind of the extreme is the affiliate gathering conference that, you know, I think it usually is held in the spring. I don't know if it's coming up. Cause I mean, again, the, I think.
No, Carl sold it, didn't he? I think.
Okay.
Carl Broadbent sold it. Yeah.
And I knew it was like on for sale, but basically I haven't caught up. So anyway, the point is like there were hundreds of people that were like only in that one little niche area.
Mm.
And now it's like, okay, where do those people go? And from my perspective, like there are other areas to start. Obviously there's like the local newsletter. I talked to people who are using Etsy as their marketplace, whether it's like digital goods or like print on demand stuff. So there are places to go with like low skill level. It's not as defensible, but you know, one of those things interesting in the niche site industry where like you got started and then there were some people who, you know, reached like a high level and then they diversified into other stuff like I did, right? Like into YouTube, podcasting, online courses. There are other people that like continued to build their skill level only in the niche site area, the authority site area. And I mean, they probably like went way further, but like because they only had that one revenue stream, like when they got hit, it's like 90% of their income like went away. And they have these great skills that are, they're not useless, but they're not as useful as they used to be. So it's good the word on the street is positive. Chris, you have a conference coming up that you're going to be speaking at. Can you tell us a little about that? Do you know what you're going to talk about?
Yeah, thanks, Doug. I'm speaking at SEO Estonia, which is in November in Estonia. I'm going to be talking about post-Harrow link building. So essentially what I've touched on today, but much more in depth. So that will be super exciting. Just to touch on one thing as well that you were just talking about 30 seconds ago. I think the other thing that was really, really sexy about niche sites and affiliate sites is the like such extreme low barrier to entry for like, you can do this with like $3 a month for like a Bluehost account. It was like, okay, that's like a monthly commitment, but it's like, it's $3. Like, or you can get 50% off for the first 12 months. Okay, it's down to like $1.50, let's say. And then it was like, everything else is your time. If you sit and write this stuff, you can make money. You've paid for your dirt cheap hosting and it's your time. So that was the real sort of draw. And then you did, like you said, you summed it up perfectly when you saw these like mom blog reports. Do you remember these like income blog reports that you see from these mommy bloggers? And they'd be making like 60K a month from their, you know, mommy blogs. And then there was a million mommy blogs. So I think it's a shame that like low cost barrier to the online world is down. But I also think if you want to do something online, find people that you trust, such as yourself, and make that investment in yourself and like pay for courses. I was speaking to John Dykstra the other day and he, you know, he had a lot of affiliate sites and, you know, he lost a lot of his traffic, but he went to learn ads and newsletter stuff. And he invested in some courses and he spends a lot of time learning and tweaking. And now he's like re-crushing it again. So it's there for us to do. We just, you know, don't cheap out on your own investment. If it's like, instead of $1.50 for half price blue hosting, if it's, you know, $100 for a course, if it's something that you really want to do, then make sure you trust the person, read some reviews and invest and give yourself the time and a chance to achieve in that area that you're interested in.
Well said, Chris. And I think like the other thing that happens is like it levels the playing field, similar to what you were saying with like, you know, coders being able to use AI and non-coders being able to use AI and like basically create something. Like I have whatever niche site skills and keyword research skills, and a lot of other people do too. But the thing is, like, everything got shuffled up. So people that like have spent 8 years working on niche sites and authority sites, they're like leveled. So like that business model, like while they still have marketing skills and some other things, like kind of level the playing field. And, you know, that's what I see where someone who has no background in digital marketing, they come up and they don't have like preconceived notions. They're just like, all right, I'm going to look at print on demand on Etsy, or I'm doing local newsletters and I see the tools that are out there and it's very easy for me to like get started. And yeah, I mean, you got to put the time in, but like, there's no clear blueprint or framework to use like there was. So I think in probably like a year or two, like there will be a couple like more mature like business models that beginners can get started in. And there it'll be, you know, kind of like say niche sites in like 2013 or 2014, where it's like there's some churn, you can get started for like low cost. It's going to pop up. I just don't know like what it'll be. Yeah. Maybe it's AI related. You know, one thing we haven't talked about much is just like video. Like we see the value of YouTube. And if you run an agency or you have something that you're selling, like, you know, video and audio, there's no better way to build trust than like hearing the person speak. And I think, you know, that's a tough thing, because like people want to do YouTube or, you know, other short form video. And it's hard to do. And a lot of times, especially on YouTube, I think some of the other platforms are different, social media based, where like, if you want to do YouTube, you're going to have to like produce a lot of videos. It's hard. It takes a long time. You have to get over the fear of like being on video and like a ton of other things before you could even earn any money. Like you have to go through all of that stuff. And it's a barrier to entry. And it's hard. And some people do it for a couple of years and they're like, I still only have like a few thousand followers, which is a lot when you think about it. But anyway, any observations on video? Just curious, like overall from, you know, agency wise, conferences, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I love video as a format. We're trying to grow our YouTube. It's not an easy thing. You definitely need to have a strategy, I think. Or just be extremely likable and like have an audience like pre-built that like wants to devour your content. But yeah, I mean, I see lots of people crushing it, especially for things like lead gen, people like Julian Goldie. So he makes a lot of content. He's in the SEO space, but you know, he makes content about AI and, you know, he's crushing it. So I think if you can get the timings right and you're not afraid to get on camera, that's the barrier, I think, isn't it, for a lot of people not wanting to put themselves out there. But yeah, there is loads of potential. I'd say niche down, and everybody says the same thing. You don't need like a full editing suite to get started. Just do it and test it and see what works and give it a go. But yeah, I like video a lot.
Very good. Okay. As we're wrapping up here, I think we're pretty much at the end of time, but I want to give you a second. You mentioned you have seen some recoveries from HCU and otherwise. Can you just give us like a little taste of like what you've seen out there?
Yeah, I don't think we've seen any full scale, like back to where they were at and shot past it. We've got some, worked with some sites in the travel space, the broad tech space and the health space, that took a dip, but they didn't tank. They did take a sizable dip, and that dip is, let's say, 75% of the way back up to where they were. I mean, that could just be that they weren't hit in any way by the helpful content update. And in actual fact, that was just like a normal algorithmic sort of part of their up and down, you know, traffic. But a lot of the sites that we see there are still loads and loads of sites killing it in Google. Like I see prospective clients all the time. I see all of our clients that get quoted in the media. I then also see the other people that have won quotes in those articles. I'll often look at their websites to see, you know, who's engaging with digital PR. There is a ton of websites doing well, like loads of just real business websites that sell like, I don't know, glass doors, let's say, and they get like 50,000 sessions a month, or like came across like a artificial grass e-commerce reseller the other day who's doing 150,000 organic sessions per month. And not for like, you know, weird keywords that don't make sense for, like, you know, is artificial grass good? Like, good keywords, you know what I mean? Loads of law firms are doing well, loads of health businesses, places like rehabilitation centers, loads of skincare and beauty products, loads of travel websites. I mean, in every vertical, there are sites that are still doing well in Google. And although it might seem like there aren't 10 organic results on every page because of all of the other crap that Google's put on there, I mean, and Reddit, let's say, which has taken up, say, 3 of the positions, there are still technically 10 spots to be on the first page of Google, and there is still significant traffic to be had. So I still think it's a game to play. I still think niche sites can work. You know, we took a client on the other day who started a site 8 months ago, and it's up to like 15,000 sessions a month. It's doing this. It's basically just a content site. It's good content. You know, there's people still playing this game as well. So it's just the rules change. So
right. And I think I'm curious to see like when, like, content websites might swing back where people are tired of maybe short form video and people want to like read a long blog. I think it'll be like very subculture specific. Like, I'm in the financial independence, retire early space as well. And people still read like the classic blogs. Like if Mr. Money Mustache writes something, like a lot of people will go there. Now that said, he's been blogging for like, whatever, 16 or 17 years and like is super well known, but there is, I mean, people do want to read some, and it's just, you know, everything changed so much so fast. It's like, you know, people are like disillusioned a little bit. People are not interested in getting started as much, but it's crazy. You know, someone started a blog a few months ago, they're just doing their thing. And, you know, they're making enough where like they can hire you and have like a true digital PR campaign going on. Yeah. So
that's really interesting. And I'll just, a final point I'll make on that. I think that you're 100% right to see if people have got a bit disillusioned. It feels almost like we're in the eye of the storm now as well. Like, we're living and breathing this, especially if you're working in this industry, the whole AI thing, it's like, it feels overwhelming. It feels like it couldn't possibly move any faster, and every day it's moving faster. But I think we do have to take a step back sometimes. And I was on Kate Toon's podcast the other day, she was on our podcast the other day, and she made a really interesting point to say that, like, as much as AI is going to be, needs to be embraced, and it's going to be a part of everything, there is always going to be the human touch and finding that balance. Like you said, sometimes I just want to read a blog article. Like, I don't want an AI generated response. I don't want the facts. Like, I want an opinion on a current news event by somebody that I think knows what they're talking about. And I think many people will feel like that. And I think there will be a step back where AI has its place, Google has its place, search engines, YouTube video has its place. Like, we're not all of a sudden just going to be AI consuming and that's it, because like you said, like Mr. Money Mustache, there's so many subcultures of industries where people respect people. Like, I'll read all of the niche newsletters still. So I'm on a bunch of newsletters. I read your newsletter, Niche Site Ladies newsletter, John Dykstra's newsletter. When they come in, I'm sitting down and reading a newsletter. There's no AI in that, unless you guys are all cheating and writing AI emails, but I don't think you are. So yeah, I think it's, you know, we have to just take a breather and see what happens, but it's going to be interesting.
You could tell when I use AI because there's no mistakes. All right, Chris, this has been awesome. It's always good to catch up. We'll link up for the cheat sheet so people can get to it. Where else should people find you?
Yeah, Chris Pantelli on LinkedIn or linkify.io if you want to have a chat, book a call, or Twitter. Yeah, all over.
All right, cool. And you got a podcast. You want to plug it here? Podcast YouTube?
Yeah. Yeah, Market Movers. If you type in Market Movers Linkify, you'll find the podcast YouTube channel. We've had some reasonably good guests. So come on, have a listen. So pretty interesting.
Cool. Yeah, we'll link up to all that stuff. And thanks again, Chris.
Cheers, Doug.